This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Ashley Jeffcoat. Teachers in Colorado's rural school districts are paid less than their counterparts along the Front Range. So if it isn't the salary, what is it that draws people to live and work there?
I'm fortunate enough to go back and talk to student teachers every year at UNC and obviously go out there and bang the drum and talk about coming to northeastern Colorado.
We'll find out why teachers might choose to work in these schools.
Suicide rates around the country are rising, especially among veterans and military service members. We'll explore this trend with a Vietnam veteran who has made it a mission to help others who are struggling.
And we'll meet some of the operators of Colorado's crisis line. They field dozens of calls every day from people across the state who are dealing with depression, anxiety, and suicidal thoughts.
We'll look at how the state and the crucial voices behind the crisis line are keeping up with the rising demand for their services.
Later, we'll explore an incredible bit of public land in Utah where the sites are mainly below ground.
And KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz reviews a movie. But first, this week it's been a scorcher. Many areas in the Mountain West are seeing record-breaking high temperatures. Chris Bianchi is a meteorologist with Weather Nation TV based in Centennial, Colorado.
Denver, for example, has been at 90 or above 28 times so far here in 2018. To put that into perspective, it's currently we're ahead of pace from 2012 even.
Firefighters are continuing to battle more than a dozen wildfires in Colorado. In total, more than 180,000 acres of land has burned so far this year.
That's a lot.
That's a whole lot.
One of the world's biggest firefighting aircraft is based in Colorado, but it's fighting fires in California right now rather than being available here in the Mountain West. The supertanker is called the Spirit of John Muir, and it is amazing. It can dump almost 20,000 gallons of water or fire retardant in 6 seconds.
That's incredible.
Kaylee Fisher is a spokesperson with the Colorado Division of Fire Prevention and Control.
It would be a huge help, a really great tool in the firefighting toolbox that we can use.
So why is that not happening? Well, it really depends on who you ask. According to Fisher, the plane still needs to be certified through the Department of the Interior. But according to the company that owns the plane, it just needs a little software update required by the U.S. Forest Service. Either way, the supertanker got temporary approval to fight fires in California. That is approval that the company says would also allow it to fly in other states like Colorado. It just so happens that California hired it first. Whatever the case for now, Colorado will keep quenching the flames using smaller aircraft. And the bright side of that, they'll be using ones that cost way less than the supertanker's rate of $26,000 an hour.
Suicides among veterans and military service members occur at a significantly higher rate than the rest of the country. That's according to new data released by the Department of Veterans Affairs. To help understand the trend, KUNC's Michael DeJuana spent some time with a Vietnam veteran living in Longmont.
When I meet Mark Drake, he's red in the face and smiling.
I was cranking so hard on the way back.
He's a little sweaty, too. Drake just finished 18 miles on his low-riding, hand-cranked bicycle. We're at the supermarket Starbucks by his house.
You know, and I was just flying. I was hitting 20 miles an hour. It's a joy to be alive.
This seemed like an odd place to talk about his war experiences and such a heavy issue, veteran suicide. But he insisted.
This is a safe place for me. Safeway?
Yeah, over coffee, he tells me he was born in California and that he moved around a lot as a kid.
He moved to Tennessee, moved to Colorado, moved to New Mexico, moved back to Colorado.
In 1969, he joined the Army because he thought he'd eventually be drafted if he didn't.
15th Med Battalion, which is Medevac.
Drake had conscientious objections, so the military made him a medic. And once he set foot in Vietnam, he found meaning in helping to save the lives of others.
The downside of the coin in Medevac was that also all the KIAs, the killed in actions, all the dead, you know, the soldiers. And that was a tough part.
He's nearly 70 years old, but the life and death he witnessed marked him. They're at the heart of the post-traumatic stress that he still experiences. It took decades for him to fully see how the war had affected him.
I'd always had certain issues, but I didn't realize really what they were.
For instance, he'd startle easily, he couldn't sleep, and when he did, he had nightmares. Then, about 20 years ago, he can't recall exactly when, a crisis changed everything.
I had suicidal thoughts. It's called ideation. And immediately I realized what it was, that this was out of the ordinary and that I needed to seek treatment.
According to the Department of Veterans Affairs annual report on suicides, veterans take their own lives at more than 2 times the rate of non-veterans. That's 20 per day. It's a number that remains relatively unchanged.
I don't want to say this is positive, but it's a start in the right direction. I mean, at least they're not rising.
Keita Franklin is executive director of the VA's National Suicide Prevention Program.
One suicide is too many, and they're all tragic, and so we're definitely trying to develop interventions.
The numbers in the VA's report are already dated, with 2015 being the most recent year cited. Still, it reveals not only a stubborn death toll, but myriad complexities. For instance, 40% of those who took their own lives did not have a mental health diagnosis.
They're struggling with relationship problems or legal struggles or financial struggles, employment and the like. It's not always mental health.
That hasn't stopped the VA from responding with a number of changes and initiatives in recent years. Everything from expanding a crisis line to support plans for troops transitioning to civilian life. There's even a website for family and friends, betherforveterans.com. Another factor highlighted in the report are different outcomes for those who recently received VA care versus those who had not.
That's an interesting phenomenon in the report this time. Like, if they're not in VA healthcare, we see those rates rising faster. So we think it points to the fact that, you know, getting into care helps.
Suicide, especially veteran suicide, is a national problem, but it has a local solution. And the local solution is the community coming together.
Dwayne France is a veteran and a mental health therapist in Colorado Springs. Besides stigma, he says access to health care is a problem for too many veterans.
Another challenge is that veterans aren't using the mental health resources at the rate that they possibly should have, and that there are barriers to that access.
Back at the Safeway in Longmont, Mark Drake says that when he felt suicidal, he didn't worry about how to access care. He just asked for emergency suicide help, and it came.
Don't be afraid to ask for help.
Support from his family helped too, as do his friends, especially other veterans.
My buddies are all really frank, and we've been together for years. It goes back to that. We all were cut from the same cloth.
Andy has his hand cycle. He started riding several years ago when the polio he contracted as a kid weakened his legs too much to ride a two-wheeler.
Oh, golly. Cycling has saved my life. I've been a cyclist since I was a kid. And the endorphins that you get from it, it allows me to completely focus on one thing, staying alive on the road.
A little humor helps, too. For KUNC, I'm Michael DeOanna.
You can go deeper with this story at KUNC.org.
And we're going to stay on this topic just a bit longer because it's important to acknowledge that anyone can struggle anytime. And for people who don't have health insurance or who simply don't know where or how to get help, Colorado has a crisis hotline that you can call or text. KUNC's Matt Bloom has more.
Colorado Support Line, this is Carolyn. Who am I speaking with?
The state's 24/7 mental health hotline was created in response to the 2012 Aurora Theater shooting. It's part of legislation passed by lawmakers that also includes walk-in clinics and a mobile crisis team.
Well, is there anything else that I can do to try to assist you tonight?
Early on, the line responded to between 4 and 8,000 interactions each month through phone calls, texts, and instant messages. It's now closer to 20,000. They help people through all sorts of things, ranging from anxiety to depression to suicidal thoughts. The line has two options for those in need, the crisis line and peer support line. The latter is more about relating one-on-one with callers, the former for finding immediate care.
You know, sometimes it's an all-hands-on-deck situation.
Jessica Stolman-Rainey is making coffee before the late shift gets started. She's worked in mental health for 8 years and with the crisis line since last fall.
You know, it's not just the people who are normally on the floor, but all the supervisors and everybody kind of has to chip in when those things happen.
She offers up a couple of theories as to why the demand has grown. It's been around for a while, so word has gotten out. And there's our obsession with social media, which can bring people together, but also has a tendency to isolate its users.
You know, not doing anything in person with people or not reaching out to people to form meaningful connections, but having these sort of surface relationships that allow people to say, I'm fine, and not be fine. and no one to know that that's what's happening.
The state's suicide rate is on the rise. It topped 1,100 last year. And there's the contagion effect, too, when other people take their lives after hearing about suicides in the news, like fashion designer Kate Spade and celebrity chef Anthony Bourdain last month. Whatever the factor, the state has responded by increasing the staff to 75 people.
And so it's making sure that we have sufficient capacity to manage that fluctuation in volumes.
Camille Harding is with the Department of Human Services and oversees the line. The legislature increased its budget by an additional $700,000 this past year. And Harding says they're kicking around the idea of building a new app to make follow-ups more streamlined.
We know that technology has a lot of opportunity to improve a variety of things, from response time all the way to having an app on your phone or being able to instant message and provide feedback about the support you received.
Another new addition is two opiate crisis specialists. One of them is Heidi L. She asked us not to use her last name for privacy reasons.
So sometimes when people are calling, they just want detox. They're not looking for a program. Some people don't know what they're doing and have no idea what to do and where to go. It's a really complex problem.
Her first contact with the crisis line was actually as a user, once during a panic attack and before a suicide attempt in 2014. She says it was an invaluable part of her recovery.
Even if I didn't have anybody else, there was somebody that gave it a damn that I was picking up the phone.
But even the people answering the phones need a break. That's why the center has what they call the Tranquility Room. Jessica Stolman-Rainey shows me their assortment of stress-relieving tools like a yoga mat, a salt lamp, and a massage chair.
I used to do jiu-jitsu, so I brought in a rebreakable board so that people can get some energy out breaking a board if they want to.
A sense of humor is also important, she says. The work of an operator can be grueling.
We ask them to do something really big, which is to meet people who are in their darkest moments, and that's a really vulnerable place to ask people to be. So it's really important for me to take care of the people that I'm asking to do that.
Without supporting them, she says, they can't support the growing number of callers.
That was Matt Bloom. The number for Colorado's crisis line is 844-493-8255. Or you can text the word TALK to 38255.
Many of us were anxiously following the story of the boys' soccer team that became trapped in an underwater cave in Thailand. Happily, all 12 boys and their coach were rescued successfully.
Yes.
And a Colorado company provided some technical help in that rescue effort. Intermap Technologies is a digital mapping company based in Inglewood. They collect and analyze geospatial digital information, which can be used to produce an interactive 3D digital map.
And that's what Intermap provided to the Thai Department of National Parks. It contained a lot of vital information on potential drilling points and drainage paths to help rescuers find alternative routes into the cave. Patrick Blott is CEO of Intermap.
All of that information, initially helped them find the missing kids, and then after that, it helped them risk mitigate and figure out what the best way to resolve the problem and extract them.
Now, the boys and their coach have been trapped in the cave since June 23rd when heavy rains flooded it. Don't go anywhere. We have lots more to get to, including Howie's review of a new documentary about punk fashion icon Vivian Westwood. Plus,
sometimes just going over that edge.
That first step backwards off a cliff?
The first step backwards off a cliff.
In just a few minutes, we're going to descend deep into a canyon in a remote part of Utah with a group of people who do a crazy sport called canyoneering.
Not us, though.
No.
But it's very cool listening to other people do it.
For now, let's keep our feet firmly planted on the ground and talk about teachers. Specifically, what it's like for teachers in rural schools on Colorado's Eastern Plains. It's true that the pay is lower, and there are fewer amenities in smaller communities. But beyond that, what is it really like to live and teach there? In the final part of her series on the teacher shortage in rural Colorado, KUNC education reporter Stephanie Daniel gives us some insight. Holyoke, Colorado is about 15 miles from the Nebraska border. It's a small town. About 2,200 people live here. Back in mid-April, I spent an afternoon talking with three teachers in the Life Studies classroom at the Holyoke Junior Senior High School. Nick Balog teaches social studies.
This is my seventh year.
I'm Hannah Peterson, and this is my first year.
Peterson also teaches social studies and coaches the girls' volleyball team. Shauna Brown teaches agriculture.
This is my second year teaching.
All of them grew up along the Front Range, and Peterson thought she'd be at one of those big schools, but she also wanted to be a head coach.
So the fact that both of those were open and offered to me was a big draw for me. Typically, from those bigger schools, I've coached at Mountain View, at Poudre High School, like bigger schools, and you definitely don't usually come in just off the get-go as the head coach.
This is Shauna. I student taught in a small school, a really small school in Southeast Colorado, so then I really saw the benefits. I don't think if I had student taught on the Front Range that I would envision myself in a smaller school.
Nick Balog graduated from the University of Northern Colorado in Greeley and moved here with his girlfriend and now wife, who was also a teacher.
It was, you know, my first full-time job, and I absolutely gave me my stepping stone to something bigger and better.
But he found that he really liked it here and has put down roots. He also made a point of spreading the word about the benefits of teaching in a rural school.
I think the nature of education is not too far removed from any profession, especially when it comes to hiring out of college. I think it's all about networking and promoting. I'm fortunate enough to go back and talk to student teachers every year at UNC, and obviously go out there and bang the drum and talk about coming to Northeastern Colorado.
Shauna Brown thinks that can start at the college level. She's an alum of Colorado State University in Fort Collins and says universities need to do a better job of steering student teachers into rural districts.
What I would really love to see happen is putting student teachers in all content areas in our rural schools for student teaching, which I know is hard to find housing and those sorts of things. But I think that would be one really important step that we could start filling our void of teachers in rural Colorado.
Which is exactly why the Colorado Department of Higher Education recently gave $300,000 to 7 colleges and universities for recruitment and retention programs to curb the shortage.
It's important to bring new teachers into the district. At the same time, it's important to keep those teachers who are in the district itself.
That's Kathy Schultz. She's the dean of the School of Education at the University of Colorado in Boulder. They use the money to start an immersion weekend so education majors can visit rural schools. CU partnered with the Northeast BOCES, short for Board of Cooperative Educational Services, on the initiative.
We know that teachers try to get jobs where they student teach.
Executive Director Brett Miles represents 12 rural school districts, including Holyoke. Of the 10 students that participated during the February tour, one did interview at a school but didn't take the job.
Our first impression was that it was worth it, and superintendents already asked that we build it into our budget next year, regardless of getting a grant or not.
The state legislature also weighed in during this year's legislative session. Governor Hickenlooper signed 4 bills targeting recruitment and retention, including one that gives a $10,000 stipend to students teach in a rural district and for 2 years after that. The last thing I asked about was pay. In Holyoke, teachers earn 34% less than the statewide average salary of $53,000. Shauna Brown and Hannah Peterson say the low cost of living here offsets the lower wages.
And me and my fiancé split the rent, so it's really cheap, but I pay $650 a month in rent.
Yourself or together?
Together, so $325.
Yeah. Mine was $675, and for a house, a 2-bedroom, 1-bathroom house. In Loveland, I was paying for a 3-bedroom apartment, I think we were paying $1,700.
And compared to the Front Range, not only is housing cheaper, but Nick Balog says the lifestyle is pretty good, too.
I mean, there's big lifestyle changes that go along with that. I don't ski 60 days a year anymore.
Dang it.
We don't, you know, go out on Saturday nights. You can only go to the 2 restaurants in town so many times. And so, you know, you trade a little bit of the nightlife for a little bit of the backyard barbecue is the nightlife here.
But even with better recruitment and state-funded programs aimed at keeping teachers in rural districts, Colorado's teacher shortage isn't going to be resolved quickly. Data from the state shows enrollment in educator preparation programs has declined by almost a quarter since 2010, and about 16% of teachers quit within the first 5 years. To compound the problem, nearly a third of current educators will be eligible for retirement in the next couple of years. That was Stephanie Daniel. You can find the other stories in that series at KUNC.org.
On KUNC, we've been taking you on a tour of some of our favorite public lands, thanks to our intrepid crew of Mountain West reporters. Today, it's more than a tour. We are taking you canyoneering. That's a crazy sport where people descend through narrow canyons using a variety of techniques, from rappelling to scrambling to swimming. KUNC's Ray Ellen Bichelle traveled to Utah at the edge, literally, of Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument.
Tammy Berry and Tom Neef are checking their bags. Harnesses, ropes, safety devices for rappelling. They're canyoneers from Moab, Utah and Boulder, Colorado. And Neef says checking his bag helps calm his nerves.
Once I get started, I'm okay. But sometimes just going over that edge.
That first step backwards off a cliff?
The first step backwards off a cliff.
We have plenty of notes about it from other canyoneers. But you never know exactly what it'll be like. Things change. Logs and rocks can fall in. Erosion and flash floods move things around. You have to be prepared, always thinking a few steps ahead.
Rock art! Rock art!
On the way in, we hike past maroon cliffs covered in ancient rock art.
I see some! Do you see the sheep?
There are spirals and swirls, double-headed sheep, and mysterious human-like figures with horns.
I mean, you can tell they're people. Look, it's like a parent holding onto their child almost.
Some of this art is thousands of years old. We keep hiking until the mesas drop off into smooth, eroded rock and then plummet into a dark channel. It's too narrow to see the bottom.
So I guess it's harvest time.
Yeah.
This is the point of no return.
Because you can't go backwards.
You usually can't. 99% of the time, you get to a point of no return and you're in.
Usually, after descending in, you pull the rope in behind you. So the way you came in no longer exists anymore. You have to find your way out together as a group. Always moving forward, down and down and down. Water's been plunging through here for millions of years. We plunge in too, using ropes.
Rope!
One by one, we rappel in from a rope tied around a rock, disappearing about 60 feet into the dark.
Ooh, it's deep.
We squeeze through a series of narrow passages, strange hallways and rooms carved by water, not a single right angle in sight.
If a snake became an architect, this is what it would design. It seems like it's built for slithering.
Cracked mud shows water was here recently, but now it's bone dry. There isn't much life down here either. Just smooth rock walls, algae, a bunch of beetles. There are some frogs.
Oh, watch out for the frog.
They're pearly white with yellow bellies, and they're clinging to the walls. They stay stock still as we squeeze past, our faces within inches of them. Eventually, the ground we've been walking on drops away into something called a keeper pothole, a smooth bowl with walls higher than a person.
This is it. We don't want to be stuck in here.
Nope. Descending into a keeper pothole can leave you feeling like an ant caught inside a wine glass. Sometimes they're even full of water. It's extremely dangerous to be stuck here during a flash flood. But today, the sky's blue and the pothole is dry.
Okay, let's go.
We pile rocks up against the wall of the pothole to use as stairs.
That's going to be hard to get out of.
Yeah.
And then we use each other's bodies like acrobats to create a human ladder.
Like circus.
Finally, about 8 hours after we started, Alejandro, the rock floor opens up.
Oh my God, there's holes everywhere.
Hey.
And then there's a dead end. Or so it seems, except for a big hole in the floor. This is the final rappel.
Kind of a blind rappel. Yo! Don't really know what's ahead.
Mandy, what do you see?
I see awesomeness.
Arm swirls and a big hole opening that you're dropping into.
We know it's a big drop into thin air, and we can feel that the space changes after that hole because wind is funneling through it. We set up ropes and send people through the hole, scooting down a smooth chute of rock and dropping over a ledge before descending free-hanging, like a spider, for about 100 feet into something called the Golden Cathedral. This is the end of the canyon, and back to the regular trail.
Holy crap!
There's a pool of water at the bottom, and ferns line the walls, moving ever so slightly.
All right, we got everybody out.
It was fantastic. Everything I had hoped for, worth every bit of effort.
Something you just would never expect you'd see.
I mean, this is what the public lands are all about.
For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Raelynn Bishel. If you want to catch up with the rest of the series on our favorite public lands, or you just want to see some amazing photos that Ray took, head on over to KUNC.org.
They are incredible. The new documentary, Westwood, Punk Icon Activist, is about the British clothing designer Vivienne Westwood, who may or may not have started the punk movement in the 1970s. For KUNC's Howie Mofshevitz, who teaches film and television at CU Denver, the film may not be about punk, it may actually be punk.
If Vivienne Westwood weren't so inexplicably interesting, Lorna Tucker's movie about her might be unwatchable. The documentary's kind of a mess, maybe by intention. It shifts directions, jumps around in time, picks up characters, loses them, doesn't always tell you who's talking, and never clues in the audience about when what happened. From Westwood's clothing and hairstyles, you might discern that this bit of footage comes from the 70s or that from the 90s. But at least for a time, she was a rebel and a punk avant-gardist, so placing her in time is no easy trick. Westwood is also not a reliable narrator of events in her own life, which also might be intentional. The movie opens with Vivienne Westwood settling into a comfy chair in front of the camera, looking put upon but stylish, and telling the filmmakers, presumably, that she really doesn't want to do this, the interview, presumably. It's a gutsy move for a film to begin with the subject saying she's bored. Westwood soon turns to her first marriage, which did not meet the American dream. Maybe she doesn't know that the American dream is not about marriage. Plus, she's an Englishwoman living in England, so it's unclear how the American dream applies to her life in the first place. Westwood claims that she started punk in the 1970s, from the back of a small shop in London called Sex, which she ran with Malcolm McLaren, who managed the punk band The Sex Pistols. There's a whiff of truth in that. On the other hand, it doesn't seem that Westwood, punk, icon, activist, has much beyond a passing commitment to literal reality. Watching the movie's like wandering through a photo gallery where the pictures are still strewn on the floor. There's the regal Vivienne Westwood in a flowing black dress with her lovely white hair styled with expensive casual elegance. In random order come photos of her in her schoolgirl bangs, then some punky images with her spiky hair. In other archival clips and photos, Westwood looks worn out, with her head covered like someone undergoing chemotherapy, although the picture never mentions any cancer episode. Many years ago, Westwood married a much younger man named Andres. One of her sons says that he's glad she has someone who's devoted to her. Andres is also credited as perhaps the primary designer in the Westwood empire. But after that tidbit of information, Andres disappears from the film for a good while, and he's absent from many scenes of the Westwood staff hard at work. Another question is how Westwood went from penniless avant-gardist to business mogul with shops all over the world. The change looks so quick, you wonder if fame and riches just zapped her over breakfast one morning. While she, in one of her guises, says the company's too big and she wants to regain control by downsizing, the film shows new shops opening in New York and Beijing. Then the CEO of the company, who looks like Tony Soprano, appears to say he worked out a deal for Westwood's company that made him rich, and you have to wonder what is that story about, and how does this guy fit into all that Vivienne Westwood has said about herself as a rebel? I came away from Westwood, punk, icon, activist, clueless about what holds this picture together, or really what it's about. It's colorful, certainly, and Westwood's fascinating the couple of times that she actually talks about the work of clothing design, as opposed to distracted, sketchy musings. Her description of how design involves literally attending to every single stitch is remarkable. There are blunt shots of models treated like mannequins, with people messing with their hair, yanking a blouse up or down or whatever. Maybe the movie itself is punk, deliberately disorganized and annoying, visually arresting, and of course provocative. For KUNC, I'm Howie Mofshevitz.
This has been Colorado Edition. This week's show was produced by Carly Huckles and by me, Ashley Jeffcoat.
And me, Erin O'Toole. Ashley also manages digital.
Editor Brian Larson contributed to our show.
Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Kalatana. Other music in this episode was Gates Open by Jay Siroc, The Glow from Tritachyon, Forest Robot Song by The Stillness of the Lake, Brook for Free with Like Swimming, and Robbie Reverb with Bling Bong.
Our outro music is Good Grief by Ryan Little. If you like what you're hearing, make sure you don't miss an episode. We'll be back next week with more great stories for you.
You can subscribe to Colorado Edition at KUNC.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.